appropriate cost, one must have a good cook and be what Mrs. Bart called decently dressed. Mrs. Bart's worst reproach to her husband was to ask him if he expected her to live like a pig, and his replying in the negative was always regarded as a justification for cabling to Paris for an extra dress or two, and telephoning to the jeweller that he might, after all, send home the turquoise bracelet which Mrs. Bart had looked at that morning. Lily knew people who lived like pigs, and their appearance and surroundings justified her mother's repugnance to that form of existence. They were mostly cousins who inhabited dingy houses with engravings from Cole's Voyage of Life on the drawing-room walls, and slatternly parlour-maids who said, "I'll go and see," to visitors calling at an hour when all right-minded persons are conventionally, if not actually, out. The disgusting part of it was that many of these cousins were rich, so that Lily imbibed the idea that if people lived like pigs, it was from choice and through the lack of any proper standard of conduct. This gave her a sense of reflected superiority, and she did not need Mrs. Bart's comments on the family frumps and misers to foster her naturally lively taste for splendor. Lily was 19 when circumstances caused her to revise her view of the universe. The previous year she had made a dazzling debut, fringed by a heavy thundercloud of bills. The light of the debut still lingered on the horizon, but the cloud had thickened, and suddenly it broke. The suddenness added to the horror, and there were still times when Lily relived with painful vividness every detail of the day on which the blow fell. She and her mother had been seated at the luncheon table over the chauffeur and cold salmon of the previous night's dinner. It was one of Mrs. Bart's few economies to consume in private the expensive remnants of her hospitality. Lily was feeling the pleasant languor which is youth's penalty for dancing till dawn. But her mother, in spite of a few lines about the mouth, and under the yellow waves on her temples, was as alert, determined, and high in colour as if she had risen from an untroubled sleep. In the centre of the table, between the melting marron glacé and candied cherries, a pyramid of American beauties lifted their vigorous stems. They held their heads as high as Mrs. Bart, but their rose colour had turned to a dissipated purple, and Lily's sense of fitness was disturbed by their reappearance on the luncheon table. "I really think, Mother," she said reproachfully, "we might afford a few fresh flowers for luncheon, just some jonquils or lilies of the valley." Mrs. Bart stared. Her own fastidiousness had its eye fixed on the world, and she did not care how the luncheon table looked when there was no one present at it but the family. But she smiled at her daughter's innocence. "Lilies of the valley," she said calmly, "cost $2 a dozen at this season." Lily was not impressed. She knew very little of the value of money. "It would not take more than 6 dozen to fill that bowl," she argued. "6 dozen what?" asked her father's voice in the doorway. The two women looked up in surprise. Though it was a Saturday, the sight of Mr. Bart at luncheon was an unwonted one. But neither his wife nor his daughter was sufficiently interested to ask an explanation. Mr. Bart dropped into a chair and sat gazing absently at the fragment of jellied salmon which the butler had placed before him. "I was only saying," Lily began, "that I hate to see faded flowers at luncheon, and Mother says a bunch of lilies of the valley would not cost more than $12. Mayn't I tell the florist to send a few every day?" She leaned confidently towards her father. He seldom refused her anything, and Mrs. Bart had taught her to plead with him when her own entreaties failed. Mr. Bart sat motionless, his gaze still fixed on the salmon, and his lower jaw dropped. He looked even paler than usual, and his thin hair lay in untidy streaks on his forehead. Suddenly he looked at his daughter and laughed. The laugh was so strange that Lily coloured under it. She disliked being ridiculed, and her father seemed to see something ridiculous in the request. Perhaps he thought it foolish that she should trouble him about such a trifle.
$12! $12 a day for flowers. Oh, certainly, my dear, give him an order for 1,200.
He continued to laugh. Mrs. Bart gave him a quick glance. "You needn't wait, Polwarth. I will ring for you," she said to the butler. The butler withdrew with an air of silent disapproval, leaving the remains of the chauffeur on the sideboard. "What is the matter, Hudson? Are you ill?" said Mrs. Bart severely. She had no tolerance for scenes which were not of her own making, and it was odious to her that her husband should make a show of himself before the servants.
"Are you ill?"
she repeated.
"Ill? No, I'm ruined," he said.
Lily made a frightened sound, and Mrs. Bart rose to her feet. "Ruined!" she cried. But controlling herself instantly, she turned a calm face to Lily.
"Shut the pantry door," she said.
Lily obeyed, and when she turned back into the room, her father was sitting with both elbows on the table, the plate of salmon between them, and his head bowed on his hands. Mrs. Bart stood over him with a white face which made her hair unnaturally yellow. She looked at Lily as the latter approached. Her look was terrible, but her voice was modulated to a ghastly cheerfulness.
"Your father is not well. He doesn't know what he's saying. It's nothing, but you'd better go upstairs, and don't talk to the servants," she added.
Lily obeyed. She always obeyed when her mother spoke in that voice. She had not been deceived by Mrs. Bart's words. She knew at once that they were ruined. In the dark hours which followed, that awful fact overshadowed even her father's slow and difficult dying. To his wife he no longer counted. He had become extinct when he ceased to fulfill his purpose, and she sat at his side with the provisional air of a traveller who waits for a belated train to start. Lily's feelings were softer. She pitied him in a frightened, ineffectual way. But the fact that he was for the most part unconscious, and that his attention, when she stole into the room, drifted away from her after a moment, made him even more of a stranger than in the nursery days when he had never come home till after dark. She seemed always to have seen him through a blur, first of sleepiness, then of distance and indifference, and now the fog had thickened till he was almost indistinguishable. If she could have performed any little services for him, or have exchanged with him a few of those affecting words which an extensive perusal of fiction had led her to connect with such occasions, the filial instinct might have stirred in her, but her pity, finding no active expression, remained in a state of spectatorship, overshadowed by her mother's grim, unflagging resentment. Every look and act of Mrs. Bart's seemed to say, "You're sorry for him now, but you'll feel differently when you see what he's done to us." It was a relief to Lily when her father died. Then a long winter set in. There was a little money left, but to Mrs. Bart it seemed worse than nothing, the mere mockery of what she was entitled to. What was the use of living if one had to live like a pig? She sank into a kind of furious apathy, a state of inert anger against fate. Her faculty for managing deserted her, or she no longer took sufficient pride in it to exert it. It was well enough to manage when by so doing one could keep one's own carriage, but when one's best contrivance did not conceal the fact that one had to go on foot, the effort was no longer worth making. Lily and her mother wandered from place to place, now paying long visits to relations whose housekeeping Mrs. Bart criticized, and who deplored the fact that she let Lily breakfast in bed when the girl had no prospect before her, and now vegetating in cheap continental refuges, where Mrs. Bart held herself fiercely aloof from the frugal tea-tables of her companions in misfortune. She was especially careful to avoid her old friends and the scenes of her former successes. To be poor seemed to her such a confession of failure that it amounted to disgrace, and she detected a note of condescension in the friendliest advances. Only one thought consoled her, and that was the contemplation of Lily's beauty. She studied it with a kind of passion, as though it were some weapon she had slowly fashioned for her vengeance. It was the last asset in their fortunes, the nucleus around which their life was to be rebuilt. She watched it jealously, as though it were her own property, and Lily its mere custodian. And she tried to instill into the latter a sense of the responsibility that such a charge involved. She followed in imagination the career of other beauties, pointing out to her daughter what might be achieved through such a gift, and dwelling on the awful warning of those who, in spite of it, had failed to get what they wanted. To Mrs. Bart, only stupidity could explain the lamentable denouement of some of her examples. She was not above the inconsistency of charging fate, rather than herself, with her own misfortunes, but she inveighed so acrimoniously against love-matches that Lily would have fancied her own marriage had been of that nature, had not Mrs. Bart frequently assured her that she had been talked into it, by whom she never made clear. Lily was duly impressed by the magnitude of her opportunities.
the dinginess of her present life threw into enchanting relief the existence to which she felt herself entitled. To a less illuminated intelligence, Mrs. Bart's counsels might have been dangerous. But Lily understood that beauty is only the raw material of conquest, and that to convert it into success, other arts are required. She knew that to betray any sense of superiority was a subtler form of the stupidity her mother denounced, and it did not take her long to learn that a beauty needs more tact than the possessor of an average set of features. Her ambitions were not as crude as Mrs. Bart's. It had been among that lady's grievances that her husband, in the early days before he was too tired, had wasted his evenings in what she vaguely described as reading poetry. And among the effects packed off to auction after his death were a score or two of dingy volumes which had struggled for existence among the boots and medicine bottles of his dressing-room shelves. There was in Lily a vein of sentiment, perhaps transmitted from this source, which gave an idealizing touch to her most prosaic purposes. She liked to think of her beauty as a power for good, as giving her the opportunity to attain a position where she should make her influence felt in the vague diffusion of refinement and good taste. She was fond of pictures and flowers and of sentimental fiction, and she could not help thinking that the possession of such tastes ennobled her desire for worldly advantages. She would not indeed have cared to marry a man who was merely rich. She was secretly ashamed of her mother's crude passion for money. Lily's preference would have been for an English nobleman with political ambitions and vast estates, or for second choice, an Italian prince with a castle in the Apennines and an hereditary office in the Vatican. Lost causes had a romantic charm for her, and she liked to picture herself as standing aloof from the vulgar press of the Quirinal and sacrificing her pleasure to the claims of an immemorial tradition. How long ago and how far off it all seemed! Those ambitions were hardly more futile and childish than the earlier ones, which had centred about the possession of a French-jointed doll with real hair. Was it only 10 years since she had wavered in imagination between the English earl and the Italian prince? Relentlessly, her mind travelled on over the dreary interval. After 2 years of hungry roaming, Mrs. Bart had died of a deep disgust. She had hated dinginess, and it was her fate to be dingy. Her visions of a brilliant marriage for Lily had faded after the first year. "People can't marry you if they don't see you, and how can they see you in these holes where we're stuck?" That was the burden of her lament, and her last adjuration to her daughter was to escape from dinginess if she could. "Don't let it creep up on you and drag you down. Fight your way out of it somehow. You're young and can do it," she insisted. She had died during one of their brief visits to New York, and there Lily at once became the centre of a family council, composed of the wealthy relatives whom she had been taught to despise for living like pigs. It may be that they had an inkling of the sentiments in which she had been brought up, for none of them manifested a very lively desire for her company. Indeed, the question threatened to remain unsolved, till Mrs. Peniston, with a sigh, announced, "I'll try her for a year." Everyone was surprised, but one and all concealed their surprise, lest Mrs. Peniston should be alarmed by it into reconsidering her decision. Mrs. Peniston was Mr. Bart's widowed sister, and if she was by no means the richest of the family group, its other members nevertheless abounded in reasons why she was clearly destined by Providence to assume the charge of Lily. In the first place, she was alone, and it would be charming for her to have a young companion. Then she sometimes travelled, and Lily's familiarity with foreign customs, deplored as a misfortune by her more conservative relatives, would at least enable her to act as a kind of courier. But as a matter of fact, Mrs. Peniston had not been affected by these considerations. She had taken the girl simply because no one else would have her, and because she had the kind of moral mauvaise honte which makes the public display of selfishness difficult, though it does not interfere with its private indulgence. It would have been impossible for Mrs. Peniston to be heroic on a desert island, but with the eyes of her little world upon her, she took a certain pleasure in her act. She reaped the reward to which disinterestedness is entitled, and found an agreeable companion in her niece. She had expected to find Lily headstrong, critical, and foreign, for even Mrs. Peniston, though she occasionally went abroad,
had the family dread of foreignness. But the girl showed a pliancy, which to a more penetrating mind than her aunt's might have been less reassuring than the open selfishness of youth. Misfortune had made Lily supple instead of hardening her, and a pliable substance is less easy to break than a stiff one. Mrs. Peniston, however, did not suffer from her niece's adaptability. Lily had no intention of taking advantage of her aunt's good nature. She was in truth grateful for the refuge offered her. Mrs. Peniston's opulent interior was at least not externally dingy. But dinginess is a quality which assumes all manner of disguises, and Lily soon found that it was as latent in the expensive routine of her aunt's life as in the makeshift existence of a continental pension. Mrs. Peniston was one of the episodical persons who form the padding of life. It was impossible to believe that she had herself ever been a focus of activities. The most vivid thing about her was the fact that her grandmother had been a Van Alstyne. This connection with the well-fed and industrious stock of early New York revealed itself in the glacial neatness of Mrs. Peniston's drawing-room and in the excellence of her cuisine. She belonged to the class of old New Yorkers who have always lived well, dressed expensively, and done little else, and to these inherited obligations Mrs. Peniston faithfully conformed. She had always been a looker-on at life, and her mind resembled one of those little mirrors which her Dutch ancestors were accustomed to affix to their upper windows, so that from the depths of an impenetrable domesticity they might see what was happening in the street. Mrs. Peniston was the owner of a country place in New Jersey, but she had never lived there since her husband's death, a remote event which appeared to dwell in her memory chiefly as a dividing point in the personal reminiscences that formed the staple of her conversation. She was a woman who remembered dates with intensity, and could tell at a moment's notice whether the drawing-room curtains had been renewed before or after Mr. Peniston's last illness. Mrs. Peniston thought the country lonely and trees damp, and cherished a vague fear of meeting a bull. To guard against such contingencies, she frequented the more populous watering-places, where she installed herself impersonally in a hired house, and looked on at life through the matting screen of her veranda. In the care of such a guardian, it soon became clear to Lily that she was to enjoy only the material advantages of good food and expensive clothing, and though far from underrating these, she would gladly have exchanged them for what Mrs. Bart had taught her to regard as opportunities. She sighed to think what her mother's fierce energies would have accomplished had they been coupled with Mrs. Peniston's resources. Lily had abundant energy of her own, but it was restricted by the necessity of adapting herself to her aunt's habits. She saw that at all costs she must keep Mrs. Peniston's favour till, as Mrs. Bart would have phrased it, she could stand on her own legs. Lily had no mind for the vagabond life of the poor relation, and to adapt herself to Mrs. Peniston she had, to some degree, to assume that lady's passive attitude. She had fancied at first that it would be easy to draw her aunt into the whirl of her own activities, but there was a static force in Mrs. Peniston, against which her niece's efforts spent themselves in vain. To attempt to bring her into active relation with life was like tugging at a piece of furniture which has been screwed to the floor. She did not indeed expect Lily to remain equally immovable. She had all the American guardian's indulgence for the volatility of youth. She had indulgence also for certain other habits of her niece's. It seemed to her natural that Lily should spend all her money on dress, and she supplemented the girl's scanty income by occasional handsome presents, meant to be applied to the same purpose. Lily, who was intensely practical, would have preferred a fixed allowance, but Mrs. Peniston liked the periodical recurrence of gratitude evoked by unexpected checks, and was perhaps shrewd enough to perceive that such a method of giving kept alive in her niece a salutary sense of dependence. Beyond this, Mrs. Peniston had not felt called upon to do anything for her charge. She had simply stood aside and let her take the field. Lily had taken it, at first with the confidence of assured possessorship, then with gradually narrowing demands, till now she found herself actually struggling for a foothold on the broad space which had once seemed her own for the asking. How it happened, she did not yet know. Sometimes she thought it was because Mrs. Peniston had been too passive, and again she feared it was because she herself had not been passive enough. Had she shown an undue eagerness for victory?
Had she lacked patience, pliancy, and dissimulation? Whether she charged herself with these faults or absolved herself from them made no difference in the sum total of her failure. Younger and plainer girls had been married off by dozens, and she was 29, and still Miss Bart. She was beginning to have fits of angry rebellion against fate, when she longed to drop out of the race and make an independent life for herself. But what manner of life would it be? She had barely enough money to pay her dressmaker's bills and her gambling debts, and none of the desultory interests which she dignified with the name of tastes was pronounced enough to enable her to live contentedly in obscurity. Ah, no. She was too intelligent not to be honest with herself. She knew that she hated dinginess as much as her mother had hated it, and to her last breath she meant to fight against it, dragging herself up again and again above its flood, till she gained the bright pinnacles of success which presented such a slippery surface to her clutch.
Chapter 4. The next morning, in her breakfast tray, Miss Bart found a note from her hostess. "Dearest Lily," it ran, "if it is not too much of a bore to be down by 10, will you come to my sitting room to help me with some tiresome things?" Lily tossed aside the note and subsided on her pillows with a sigh. It was a bore to be down by 10, an hour regarded at Bellamont as vaguely synchronous with sunrise, and she knew too well the nature of the tiresome things in question. Miss Prague, the secretary, had been called away, and there would be notes and dinner cards to write, lost addresses to hunt up, and other social drudgery to perform. It was understood that Miss Bart should fill the gap in such emergencies, and she usually recognized the obligation without a murmur. Today, however, it renewed the sense of servitude which the previous night's review of her checkbook had produced. Everything in her surroundings ministered to feelings of ease and amenity. The windows stood open to the sparkling freshness of the September morning, and between the yellow boughs she caught a perspective of hedges and parterres leading by degrees of lessening formality to the free undulations of the park. Her maid had kindled a little fire on the hearth, and it contended cheerfully with the sunlight which slanted across the moss-green carpet and caressed the curved sides of an old marquetry desk. Near the bed stood a table holding her breakfast tray, with its harmonious porcelain and silver, a handful of violets in a slender glass, and the morning paper folded beneath her letters. There was nothing new to Lily in these tokens of a studied luxury. But though they formed a part of her atmosphere, she never lost her sensitiveness to their charm. Mere display left her with a sense of superior distinction, but she felt an affinity to all the subtler manifestations of wealth. Mrs. Trenor's summons, however, suddenly recalled her state of dependence, and she rose and dressed in a mood of irritability that she was usually too prudent to indulge. She knew that such emotions leave lines on the face as well as in the character, and she had meant to take warning by the little creases which her midnight survey had revealed. The matter-of-course tone of Mrs. Trenor's greeting deepened her irritation. If one did drag oneself out of bed at such an hour and come down fresh and radiant to the monotony of note-writing, some special recognition of the sacrifice seemed fitting. But Mrs. Trenor's tone showed no consciousness of the fact. "Oh, Lily, that's nice of you," she merely sighed across the chaos of letters, bills, and other domestic documents, which gave an incongruously commercial touch to the slender elegance of her writing-table. "There are such lots of horrors this morning," she added, clearing a space in the center of the confusion and rising to yield her seat to Miss Bart. Mrs. Trenor was a tall, fair woman, whose height just saved her from redundancy. Her rosy blondness had survived some 40 years of futile activity without showing much trace of ill usage, except in a diminished play of feature. It was difficult to define her, beyond saying that she seemed to exist only as a hostess, not so much from any exaggerated instinct of hospitality, as because she could not sustain life except in a crowd. The collective nature of her interests exempted her from the ordinary rivalries of her sex, and she knew no more personal emotion than that of hatred for the woman who presumed to give bigger dinners or have more amusing house-parties than herself. As her social talents, backed by Mr. Trenor's bank account, almost always assured her ultimate triumph in such competitions, Success had developed in her an unscrupulous good nature toward the rest of her sex, and in Miss Bart's utilitarian classification of her friends, Mrs. Trenor ranked as the woman who was least likely to go back on her. It was simply inhuman of Prague to go off now, Mrs. Trenor declared, as her friend seated herself at the desk. She says her sister is going to have a baby, as if that were anything to having a house party. I'm sure I shall get most horribly mixed up, and there'll be some awful rows. When I was down at Tuxedo, I asked a lot of people for next week, and I've mislaid the list and can't remember who's coming. And this week is going to be a hard failure, too, and Gwen Van Osburgh will go back and tell her mother how bored people were. I didn't mean to ask the Wetherills. That was a blunder of Gus's. They disapprove of Carrie Fisher, you know, as if one could help having Carrie Fisher. It was foolish of her to get that second divorce. Carrie always overdoes things, but she said the only way to get a penny out of Fisher was to divorce him and make him pay alimony. And poor Carrie has to consider every dollar. It's really absurd of Alice Wetherill to make such a fuss about meeting her when one thinks of what society is coming to. Someone said the other day that there was a divorce and a case of appendicitis in every family one knows. Besides, Carrie is the only person who can keep Gus in a good humor when we have bores in the house. Have you noticed that all the husbands like her, all I mean except her own? It's rather clever of her to have made such a specialty of devoting herself to dull people. The field is such a large one, and she has it practically to herself. She finds compensations, no doubt. I know she borrows money of Gus, but then I'd pay her to keep him in a good humor, so I can't complain, after all. Mrs. Trenor paused to enjoy the spectacle of Miss Bart's efforts to unravel her tangled correspondence. "But it isn't only the Wetherills and Carrie," she resumed, with a fresh note of lament. "The truth is, I'm awfully disappointed in Lady Cressida Wraith." "Disappointed? Hadn't you known her before?" "Mercy, no. Never saw her till yesterday. Lady Skiddaw sent her over with letters to the Van Osburghs, and I heard that Maria Van Osburgh was asking a big party to meet her this week, so I thought it would be fun to get her away, and Jack Stepney, who knew her in India, managed it for me. Maria was furious, and actually had the impudence to make Gwen invite herself here, so that they shouldn't be quite out of it. If I'd known what Lady Cressida was like, they could have had her and welcome. But I thought any friend of the Skiddaws was sure to be amusing. You remember what fun Lady Skiddaw was?" There were times when I simply had to send the girls out of the room. Besides, Lady Cressida is the Duchess of Beltshire's sister, and I naturally suppose she was the same sort. But you never can tell in those English families. They are so big that there's room for all kinds, and it turns out that Lady Cressida is the moral one. Married a clergyman, does missionary work in the East End. Think of my taking such a lot of trouble about a clergyman's wife who wears Indian jewelry and botanizes. She made Gus take her all through the glass houses yesterday and bothered him to death by asking him the names of the plants. Fancy treating Gus as if he were the gardener. Mrs. Trenor brought this out in a crescendo of indignation. Oh, well, perhaps Lady Cressida will reconcile the Wetherills to meeting Carrie Fisher, said Miss Bart pacifically. I'm sure I hope so. But she's boring all the men horribly, and if she takes to distributing tracts, as I hear she does, it will be too depressing. The worst of it is that she would have been so useful at the right time. You know we have to have the bishop once a year, and she would have given just the right tone to things. I always have horrid luck about the bishop's visit, added Mrs. Trenor, whose present misery was being fed by a rapidly rising tide of reminiscence. Last year, when he came, Gus forgot all about his being here and brought home the Ned Wintons and the Farleys, 5 divorces and 6 sets of children between them. "When is Lady Cressida going?" Lily inquired. Mrs. Trenor cast up her eyes in despair. "My dear, if one only knew! I was in such a hurry to get away from Maria that I actually forgot to name a date, and Gus says she told someone she meant to stop here all winter." "To stop here? In this house?" "Don't be silly. In America. But if no one else asks her, you know they never go to hotels." "Perhaps Gus only said it to frighten you." "No, I heard her tell Bertha Dorset that she had 6 months to put in while her husband was taking the cure in the Engadine. You should have seen Bertha look vacant. But it's no joke, you know. If she stays here all the autumn, she'll spoil everything, and Maria Van Osburgh will simply exult." At this affecting vision, Mrs. Trenor's voice trembled with self-pity. "Oh, Judy, as if anyone were ever bored at Bellamont," Miss Bart tactfully protested. "You know perfectly well that if Mrs. Van Osburgh were to get all the right people and leave you with all the wrong ones, you'd manage to make things go off, and she wouldn't."
Such an assurance would usually have restored Mrs. Trenor's complacency, but on this occasion it did not chase the cloud from her brow. "It isn't only Lady Cressida," she lamented. "Everything has gone wrong this week. I can see that Bertha Dorset is furious with me."
"Furious with you? Why?"
"Because I told her that Lawrence Selden was coming. But he wouldn't, after all, and she's quite unreasonable enough to think it's my fault."
Miss Bart put down her pen and sat absently gazing at the note she had begun.
"I thought that was all over," she said. "So it is, on his side. And, of course, Bertha hasn't been idle since. But I fancy she's out of a job just at present, and someone gave me a hint that I had better ask Lawrence. Well, I did ask him, but I couldn't make him come. And now I suppose she'll take it out of me by being perfectly nasty to everyone else."
"Oh, she may take it out of him by being perfectly charming to someone else."
Mrs. Trenor shook her head dolefully. "She knows he wouldn't mind. And who else is there? Alice Wetherell won't let Lucius out of her sight. Ned Silverton can't take his eyes off Carrie Fisher, poor boy. Gus is bored by Bertha. Jack Stepney knows her too well. And, well, to be sure, there's Percy Gryce."
She sat up, smiling at the thought. Miss Bart's countenance did not reflect the smile. Oh, she and Mr. Gryce would not be likely to hit it off.
"You mean that she'd chalk him and he'd bore her? Well, that's not such a bad beginning, you know. But I hope she won't take it into her head to be nice to him, for I asked him here on purpose for you."
Lily laughed. "Merci du compliment. I should certainly have no show against Bertha."
"Do you think I'm uncomplimentary? I'm not really, you know. Everyone knows you're 1,000 times handsomer and cleverer than Bertha. But then you're not nasty. And for always getting what she wants in the long run, commend me to a nasty woman."
Miss Bart stared in affected reproval. "I thought you were so fond of Bertha."
"Oh, I am. It's much safer to be fond of dangerous people. But she is dangerous. And if I ever saw her up to mischief, it's now. I can tell by poor George's manner. That man is a perfect barometer. He always knows when Bertha is going to..."
"To fall," Miss Bart suggested.
"Don't be shocking. You know he believes in her still. And, of course, I don't say there's any real harm in Bertha. Only she delights in making people miserable, and especially poor George."
"Well, he seems cut out for the part. I don't wonder she likes more cheerful companionship."
"Oh, George is not as dismal as you think. If Bertha didn't worry him, he would be quite different. Or she'd leave him alone and let him arrange his life as he pleases. But she doesn't dare lose her hold of him on account of the money. And so when he isn't jealous, she pretends to be."
Miss Bart went on writing in silence, and her hostess sat following her train of thought with frowning intensity.
"Do you know," she exclaimed after a long pause, "I believe I'll call up Lawrence on the telephone and tell him he simply must come."
"Oh, don't," said Lily, with a quick suffusion of color. The blush surprised her almost as much as it did her hostess, who, though not commonly observant of facial changes, sat staring at her with puzzled eyes.
"Good gracious, Lily, how handsome you are! Why, do you dislike him so much?"
"Not at all. I like him. But if you are actuated by the benevolent intention of protecting me from Bertha, I don't think I need your protection."
Mrs. Trenor sat up with an exclamation. "Lily! Percy! Do you mean to say you've actually done it?"
Miss Bart smiled. "I only mean to say that Mr. Gryce and I are getting to be very good friends."
I see."
Mrs. Trenor fixed a rapt eye upon her.
"You know, they say he has 800,000 a year and spends nothing except on some rubbishy old books. And his mother has heart disease and will leave him a lot more. Oh, Lily, do go slowly," her friend adjured her.
Miss Bart continued to smile without annoyance. "I shouldn't, for instance," she remarked, "be in any haste to tell him that he had a lot of rubbishy old books."
"No, of course not. I know you're wonderful about getting up people's subjects, but he's horribly shy and easily shocked, and...
"Why don't you say it, Judy? I have the reputation of being on the hunt for a rich husband."
"Oh, I don't mean that. He wouldn't believe it of you, at first," said Mrs. Trenor, with candid shrewdness. But you know, things are rather lively here at times. I must give Jack and Gus a hint. And if he thought you were what his mother would call fast... Oh, well, you know what I mean. Don't wear your scarlet crepe de chine for dinner, and don't smoke, if you can help it, Lily dear.
Lily pushed aside her finished work with a dry smile. You're very kind, Judy. I'll lock up my cigarettes and wear that last year's dress you sent me this morning. And if you're really interested in my career, perhaps you'll be kind enough not to ask me to play bridge again this evening.
Bridge? Does he mind bridge, too? Oh, Lily, what an awful life you'll lead. But of course I won't. Why didn't you give me a hint last night? There's nothing I wouldn't do, you poor duck, to see you happy.
And Mrs. Trenor, glowing with her sex's eagerness to smooth the course of true love, enveloped Lily in a long embrace.
You're quite sure, she added solicitously, as the latter extricated herself, that you wouldn't like me to telephone for Lawrence Selden?
Quite sure, said Lily. The next 3 days demonstrated to her own complete satisfaction Miss Bart's ability to manage her affairs without extraneous aid. As she sat on the Saturday afternoon on the terrace at Bellamont, she smiled at Mrs. Trenor's fear that she might go too fast. If such a warning had ever been needful, the years had taught her a salutary lesson, and she flattered herself that she now knew how to adapt her pace to the object of pursuit. In the case of Mr. Gryce, she had found it well to flutter ahead, losing herself elusively and luring him on from depth to depth of unconscious intimacy. The surrounding atmosphere was propitious to this scheme of courtship. Mrs. Trenor, true to her word, had shown no signs of expecting Lily at the bridge table, and had even hinted to the other card players that they were to betray no surprise at her unwonted defection. In consequence of this hint, Lily found herself the centre of that feminine solicitude which envelops a young woman in the mating season. A solitude was tacitly created for her in the crowded existence of Bellamont, and her friends could not have shown a greater readiness for self-effacement had her wooing been adorned with all the attributes of romance. In Lily's set, this conduct implied a sympathetic comprehension of her motives, and Mr. Gryce rose in her esteem as she saw the consideration he inspired. The terrace at Bellamont on a September afternoon was a spot propitious to sentimental musings, and as Miss Bart stood leaning against the balustrade above the sunken garden, at a little distance from the animated group about the tea-table, she might have been lost in the mazes of an inarticulate happiness. In reality, her thoughts were finding definite utterance in the tranquil recapitulation of the blessings in store for her. From where she stood, she could see them embodied in the form of Mr. Gryce, who in a light overcoat and muffler sat somewhat nervously on the edge of his chair, while Carrie Fisher, with all the energy of eye and gesture with which nature and art had combined to endow her, pressed on him the duty of taking part in the task of municipal reform. Mrs. Fisher's latest hobby was municipal reform. It had been preceded by an equal zeal for socialism, which had in turn replaced an energetic advocacy of Christian Science. Mrs. Fisher was small, fiery, and dramatic, and her hands and eyes were admirable instruments in the service of whatever cause she happened to espouse. She had, however, the fault common to enthusiasts of ignoring any slackness of response on the part of her hearers, and Lily was amused by her unconsciousness of the resistance displayed in every angle of Mr. Gryce's attitude. Lily herself knew that his mind was divided between the dread of catching cold if he remained out of doors too long at that hour, and the fear that if he retreated to the house, Mrs. Fisher might follow him up with a paper to be signed. Mr. Gryce had a constitutional dislike to what he called committing himself, and tenderly as he cherished his health, he evidently concluded that it was safer to stay out of reach of pen and ink till chance released him from Mrs. Fisher's toils. Meanwhile, he cast agonized glances in the direction of Miss Bart, whose only response was to sink into an attitude of more graceful abstraction. She had learned the value of contrast in throwing her charms into relief, and was fully aware of the extent to which Mrs. Fisher's volubility was enhancing her own repose. She was roused from her musings by the approach of her cousin, Jack Stepney, who at Gwen Van Osburgh's side was returning across the garden from the tennis court. The couple in question were engaged in the same kind of romance in which Lily figured, and the latter felt a certain annoyance in contemplating what seemed to her a caricature of her own situation. Miss Van Osburgh was a large girl with flat surfaces and no highlights. Jack Stepney had once said of her that she was as reliable as roast mutton. His own taste was in the line of less solid and more highly seasoned diet, but hunger makes any fare palatable, and there had been times when Mr. Stepney had been reduced to a crust. Lily considered with interest the expression of their faces. The girls turned toward her companions like an empty plate held up to be filled, while the man lounging at her side already betrayed the encroaching boredom which would presently crack the thin veneer of his smile. "How impatient men are," Lily reflected. "All Jack has to do to get everything he wants is to keep quiet and let that girl marry him, whereas I have to calculate and contrive and retreat and advance, as if I were going through an intricate dance, when one misstep would throw me hopelessly out of time." As they drew nearer, she was whimsically struck by a kind of family likeness between Miss Van Osburgh and Percy Gryce. There was no resemblance of feature. Gryce was handsome in a didactic way. He looked like a clever pupil's drawing from a plaster cast, while Gwen's countenance had no more modelling than a face painted on a toy balloon. But the deeper affinity was unmistakable. The two had the same prejudices and ideals, and the same quality of making other standards non-existent by ignoring them. This attribute was common to most of Lily's set. They had a force of negation which eliminated everything beyond their own range of perception. Gryce and Miss Van Osburgh were, in short, made for each other by every law of moral and physical correspondence. "Yet they wouldn't look at each other," Lily mused. "They never do. Each of them wants a creature of a different race, of Jack's race and mine, with all sorts of intuitions, sensations, and perceptions that they don't even guess the existence of. And they always get what they want." She stood talking with her cousin and Miss Van Osburgh, till a slight cloud on the latter's brow advised her that even cousinly amenities were subject to suspicion, and Miss Bart, mindful of the necessity of not exciting enmities at this crucial point of her career, dropped aside while the happy couple proceeded toward the tea-table. Seating herself on the upper step of the terrace, Lily leaned her head against the honeysuckles wreathing the balustrade. The fragrance of the late blossoms seemed an emanation of the tranquil scene, a landscape tutored to the last degree of rural elegance. In the foreground glowed the warm tints of the gardens. Beyond the lawn, with its pyramidal pale gold maples and velvety firs, sloped pastures dotted with cattle, and through a long glade the river widened like a lake under the silver light of September. Lily did not want to join the circle about the tea-table. They represented the future she had chosen, and she was content with it, but in no haste to anticipate its joys. The certainty that she could marry Percy Gryce when she pleased had lifted a heavy load from her mind, and her money troubles were too recent for their removal not to leave a sense of relief, which a less discerning intelligence might have taken for happiness. Her vulgar cares were at an end. She would be able to arrange her life as she pleased, to soar into that empyrean of security where creditors cannot penetrate. She would have smarter gowns than Judy Trenor, and far, far more jewels than Bertha Dorset. She would be free forever from the shifts, the expedients, the humiliations of the relatively poor. Instead of having to flatter, she would be flattered. Instead of being grateful, she would receive thanks. There were old scores she could pay off, as well as old benefits she could return, and she had no doubts as to the extent of her power. She knew that Mr. Gryce was of the small, chary type, most inaccessible to impulses and emotions. He had the kind of character in which prudence is a vice, and good advice the most dangerous nourishment. But Lily had known the species before. She was aware that such a guarded nature must find one huge outlet of egoism, and she determined to be to him what his Americana had hitherto been, the one possession in which he took sufficient pride to spend money on it. She knew that this generosity to self is one of the forms of meanness, and she resolved so to identify herself with her husband's vanity that to gratify her wishes would be to him the most exquisite form of self-indulgence. The system might at first necessitate a resort to some of the very shifts and expedients from which she intended it should free her, but she felt sure that in a short time she would be able to play the game in her own way. How should she have distrusted her powers? Her beauty itself was not the mere ephemeral possession it might have been in the hands of inexperience. Her skill in enhancing it, the care she took of it, the use she made of it, seemed to give it a kind of permanence. She felt she could trust it to carry her through to the end. And the end, on the whole, was worthwhile. Life was not the mockery she had thought it 3 days ago. There was room for her, after all, in this crowded, selfish world of pleasure, when, so short a time since, her poverty had seemed to exclude her. These people, whom she had ridiculed and yet envied, were glad to make a place for her in the charmed circle about which all her desires revolved. They were not as brutal and self-engrossed as she had fancied, or rather, since it would no longer be necessary to flatter and humor them, that side of their nature became less conspicuous. Society is a revolving body which is apt to be judged according to its place in each man's heaven, and at present it was turning its illuminated face to Lily. In the rosy glow it diffused, her companions seemed full of amiable qualities. She liked their elegance, their lightness, their lack of emphasis. Even the self-assurance, which at times was so like obtuseness, now seemed the natural sign of social ascendancy. They were lords of the only world she cared for, and they were ready to admit her to their ranks and let her lord it with them. Already she felt within her a stealing allegiance to their standards, an acceptance of their limitations, a disbelief in the things they did not believe in, a contemptuous pity for the people who were not able to live as they lived. The early sunset was slanting across the park. Through the boughs of the long avenue beyond the gardens, she caught the flash of wheels and divined that more visitors were approaching. There was a movement behind her, a scattering of steps and voices. It was evident that the party about the tea-table was breaking up. Presently she heard a tread behind her on the terrace. She supposed that Mr. Gryce had at last found means to escape from his predicament, and she smiled at the significance of his coming to join her, instead of beating an instant retreat to the fireside. She turned to give him the welcome which such gallantry deserved, but her greeting wavered into a blush of wonder, for the man who had approached her was Lawrence Selden. "You see, I came after all," he said. But before she had time to answer, Mrs. Dorset, breaking away from a lifeless colloquy with her host, had stepped between them with a little gesture of appropriation. Chapter 5. The observance of Sunday at Bellamont was chiefly marked by the punctual appearance of the smart omnibus destined to convey the household to the little church at the gates. Whether anyone got into the omnibus or not was a matter of secondary importance, since by standing there it not only bore witness to the orthodox intentions of the family, but made Mrs. Trenor feel, when she finally heard it drive away, that she had somehow vicariously made use of it. It was Mrs. Trenor's theory that her daughters actually did go to church every Sunday, but their French governess's convictions calling her to the rival fane, and the fatigues of the week keeping their mother in her room till luncheon, there was seldom anyone present to verify the fact. Now and then, in a spasmodic burst of virtue, when the house had been too uproarious overnight, Gus Trenor forced his genial bulk into a tight frock coat and routed his daughters from their slumbers. But habitually, as Lily explained to Mr. Gryce, this parental duty was forgotten till the church bells were ringing across the park and the omnibus had driven away empty. Lily had hinted to Mr. Gryce that this neglect of religious observances was repugnant to her early traditions, and that during her visits to Bellamont she regularly accompanied Muriel and Hilda to church. This tallied with the assurance also confidentially imparted that, never having played bridge before, she had been dragged into it on the night of her arrival, and had lost an appalling amount of money in consequence of her ignorance of the game and of the rules of betting. Mr. Gryce was undoubtedly enjoying Bellamont. He liked the ease and glitter of the life, and the lustre conferred on him by being a member of this group of rich and conspicuous people. But he thought it a very materialistic society. There were times when he was frightened by the talk of the men and the looks of the ladies, and he was glad to find that Miss Bart, for all her ease and self-possession, was not at home in so ambiguous an atmosphere. For this reason he had been especially pleased to learn that she would, as usual, attend the young Trenners to church on Sunday morning. And as he paced the gravel sweep before the door, his light overcoat on his arm and his prayer book in one carefully gloved hand, he reflected agreeably on the strength of character which kept her true to her early training in surroundings so subversive to religious principles. For a long time, Mr. Gryce and the omnibus had the gravel sweep to themselves. But far from regretting this deplorable indifference on the part of the other guests, he found himself nourishing the hope that Miss Bart might be unaccompanied. The precious minutes were flying, however. The big chestnuts pawed the ground and flecked their impatient sides with foam. The coachman seemed to be slowly petrifying on the box and the groom on the doorstep, and still the lady did not come. Suddenly, however, there was a sound of voices and a rustle of skirts in the doorway, and Mr. Gryce, restoring his watch to his pocket, turned with a nervous start. But it was only to find himself handing Mrs. Wetherill into the carriage. The Wetherills always went to church. They belonged to the vast group of human automata who go through life without neglecting to perform a single one of the gestures executed by the surrounding puppets. It is true that the Bellamont puppets did not go to church, but others equally important did, and Mr. and Mrs. Wetherill's circle was so large that God was included in their visiting list. They appeared, therefore, punctual and resigned, with the air of people bound for a dull at home, and after them Hilda and Muriel straggled, yawning and pinning each other's veils and ribbons as they came. They had promised Lily to go to church with her, they declared, and Lily was such a dear old duck that they didn't mind doing it to please her, though they couldn't fancy what had put the idea in her head, and though for their own part they would much rather have played lawn tennis with Jack and Gwen if she hadn't told them she was coming. The Mrs. Trenner were followed by Lady Cressida Wraith, a weather-beaten person in Liberty silk and ethnological trinkets, who, on seeing the omnibus, expressed her surprise that they were not to walk across the park. But at Mrs. Wetherill's horrified protest that the church was a mile away, her ladyship, after a glance at the height of the other's heels, acquiesced in the necessity of driving, and poor Mr. Gryce found himself rolling off between four ladies for whose spiritual welfare he felt not the least concern. It might have afforded him some consolation could he have known that Miss Bard had really meant to go to church. She had even risen earlier than usual in the execution of her purpose. She had an idea that the sight of her in a grey gown of devotional cut, with her famous lashes drooped above a prayer book, would put the finishing touch to Mr. Gryce's subjugation, and render inevitable a certain incident which she had resolved should form a part of the walk they were to take together after luncheon. Her intentions, in short, had never been more definite. But poor Lily, for all the hard glaze of her exterior, was inwardly as malleable as wax. Her faculty for adapting herself, for entering into other people's feelings, if it served her now and then in small contingencies, hampered her in the decisive moments of life. She was like a water plant in the flux of the tides, and today the whole current of her mood was carrying her toward Lawrence Selden. Why had he come? Was it to see herself or Bertha Dorset? It was the last question which at that moment should have engaged her. She might better have contented herself with thinking that he had simply responded to the despairing summons of his hostess, anxious to interpose him between herself and the ill humour of Mrs. Dorset. But Lily had not rested till she learned from Mrs. Trenner that Selden had come of his own accord. "He didn't even wire me. He just happened to find the trap at the station. Perhaps it's not over with Bertha after all," Mrs. Trenner musingly concluded, and went away to arrange her dinner cards accordingly. Perhaps it was not, Lily reflected, but it should be soon, unless she had lost her cunning. If Selden had come at Mrs. Dorset's call, it was at her own that he would stay. So much the previous evening had told her. Mrs. Trenner, true to her simple principle of making her married friends happy, had placed Selden and Mrs. Dorset next to each other at dinner. But in obedience to the time-honoured traditions of the matchmaker, she had separated Lily and Mr. Gryce, sending in the former with George Dorset, while Mr. Gryce was coupled with Gwen Van Osburgh. George Dorset's talk did not interfere with the range of his neighbour's thoughts. He was a mournful dyspeptic, intent on finding out the deleterious ingredients of every dish, and diverted from this care only by the sound of his wife's voice. On this occasion, however, Mrs. Dorset took no part in the general conversation. she sat talking in low murmurs with Selden, and turning a contemptuous and denuded shoulder toward her host, who, far from resenting his exclusion, plunged into the excesses of the menu with the joyous irresponsibility of a free man. To Mr. Dorset, however, his wife's attitude was a subject of such evident concern that when he was not scraping the sauce from his fish or scooping the moist breadcrumbs from the interior of his roll, he sat straining his thin neck for a glimpse of her between the lights. Mrs. Trenor, as it chanced, had placed the husband and wife on opposite sides of the table, and Lily was therefore able to observe Mrs. Dorset also, and by carrying her glance a few feet farther, to set up a rapid comparison between Lawrence Selden and Mr. Gryce. It was that comparison which was her undoing. Why else had she suddenly grown interested in Selden? She had known him for 8 years or more. Ever since her return to America, he had formed a part of her background. She had always been glad to sit next to him at dinner, had found him more agreeable than most men, and had vaguely wished that he possessed the other qualities needful to fix her attention. But till now she had been too busy with her own affairs to regard him as more than one of the pleasant accessories of life. Miss Bart was a keen reader of her own heart, and she saw that her sudden preoccupation with Selden was due to the fact that his presence shed a new light on her surroundings. Not that he was notably brilliant or exceptional. In his own profession he was surpassed by more than one man who had bored Lily through many a weary dinner. It was rather that he had preserved a certain social detachment, a happy air of viewing the show objectively, of having points of contact outside the great gilt cage in which they were all huddled for the mob to gape at. How alluring the world outside the cage appeared to Lily as she heard its door clang on her. In reality, as she knew, the door never clanged. It stood always open. But most of the captives were like flies in a bottle, and having once flown in, could never regain their freedom. It was Selden's distinction that he had never forgotten the way out. That was the secret of his way of readjusting her vision. Lily, turning her eyes from him, found herself scanning her little world through his retina. It was as though the pink lamps had been shut off and the dusty daylight let in. She looked down the long table, studying its occupants one by one, from Gus Trenor, with his heavy, carnivorous head sunk between his shoulders as he preyed on a jellied plover, to his wife at the opposite end of the long bank of orchids, suggestive, with her glaring good looks, of a jeweller's window lit by electricity. And between the two, what a long stretch of vacuity! How dreary and trivial these people were! Lily reviewed them with a scornful impatience. Carrie Fisher, with her shoulders, her eyes, her divorces, her general air of embodying a spicy paragraph. Young Silverton, who had meant to live on proofreading and write an epic, and who now lived on his friends and had become critical of truffles. Alice Wetherill, an animated visiting list, whose most fervid convictions turned on the wording of invitations and the engraving of dinner cards. Wetherill, with his perpetual nervous nod of acquiescence, his air of agreeing with people before he knew what they were saying. Jack Stepney, with his confident smile and anxious eyes, halfway between the sheriff and an heiress. Gwen Van Osburgh, with all the guileless confidence of a young girl who has always been told that there is no one richer than her father. Lily smiled at her classification of her friends. How different they had seemed to her a few hours ago. Then they had symbolized what she was gaining. Now they stood for what she was giving up. That very afternoon they had seemed full of brilliant qualities. Now she saw that they were merely dull in a loud way. Under the glitter of their opportunities, she saw the poverty of their achievement. It was not that she wanted them to be more disinterested, but she would have liked them to be more picturesque. And she had a shamed recollection of the way in which, a few hours since, she had felt the centripetal force of their standards. She closed her eyes an instant, and the vacuous routine of the life she had chosen stretched before her like a long white road without dip or turning. It was true she was to roll over it in a carriage instead of trudging it on foot, but sometimes the pedestrian enjoys the diversion of a short cut which is denied to those on wheels. She was roused by a chuckle which Mr. Dorset seemed to eject from the depths of his lean throat. "I say, do look at her," he exclaimed, turning to Miss Bart with lugubrious merriment.
I beg your pardon, but do just look at my wife making a fool of that poor devil over there. One would really suppose she was gone on him, and it's all the other way around, I assure you.
Thus adjured, Lily turned her eyes on the spectacle which was affording Mr. Dorset such legitimate mirth. It certainly appeared, as he said, that Mrs. Dorset was the more active participant in the scene. Her neighbour seemed to receive her advances with a temperate zest which did not distract him from his dinner. The sight restored Lily's good humour, and knowing the peculiar disguise which Mr. Dorset's marital fears assumed, she asked gaily, "Aren't you horribly jealous of her?" Dorset greeted the sally with delight.
"Oh, abominably, you just hit it. Keeps me awake at night. The doctors tell me that's what has knocked my digestion out, being so infernally jealous of her. I can't eat a mouthful of this stuff, you know," he added suddenly, pushing back his plate with a clouded countenance.
And Lily, unfailingly adaptable, accorded her radiant attention to his prolonged denunciation of other people's cooks, with a supplementary tirade on the toxic qualities of melted butter. It was not often that he found so ready an ear, and being a man as well as a dyspeptic, it may be that as he poured his grievances into it, he was not insensible to its rosy symmetry. At any rate, he engaged Lily so long that the sweets were being handed, when she caught a phrase on her other side, where Miss Corby, the comic woman of the company, was bantering Jack Stepney on his approaching engagement. Miss Corby's role was jocularity. She always entered the conversation with a handspring.
"And of course you'll have Sim Rosedale as best man,"
Lily heard her fling out as the climax of her prognostications. And Stepney responded as if struck,
"Jove, that's an idea. What a thumping present I'd get out of him."
Sim Rosedale. The name, made more odious by its diminutive, obtruded itself on Lily's thoughts like a leer. It stood for one of the many hated possibilities hovering on the edge of life. If she did not marry Percy Gryce, the day might come when she would have to be civil to such men as Rosedale. If she did not marry him. But she meant to marry him. She was sure of him and sure of herself. She drew back with a shiver from the pleasant paths in which her thoughts had been straying, and set her feet once more in the middle of the long white road. When she went upstairs that night, she found that the late post had brought her a fresh batch of bills. Mrs. Peniston, who was a conscientious woman, had forwarded them all to Bellamont. Miss Bart accordingly rose the next morning with the most earnest conviction that it was her duty to go to church. She tore herself betimes from the lingering enjoyment of her breakfast tray, rang to have her grey gown laid out, and dispatched her maid to borrow a prayer book for Mrs. Trenor. But her course was too purely reasonable not to contain the germs of rebellion. No sooner were her preparations made than they roused a smothered sense of resistance. A small spark was enough to kindle Lily's imagination, and the sight of the grey dress and the